You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of December 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
Now, tonight here in Brussels, we're going to have a conversation dedicated to Britain's renegotiation of its position in Europe. And I want to see real progress in all of the four areas that I've mentioned. We're not pushing for a deal tonight, but we're pushing for real momentum.
David Cameron there, as EU leaders meet in Brussels for the last summit of 2015, my guests Michael Binion and Mary Dzhevsky will tell us their thoughts on this and the day's other top stories, including Vladimir Putin's annual news conference. He had some harsh words for Turkey.
I don't understand why they did it. What have they achieved? Did they think that we would run away from there? Of course not. Russia is not that kind of country.
Also ahead, we turn to the United Nations, where countries are expected to adopt a resolution to starve the so-called Islamic State of funding. But will it work? All that, plus a look at FIFA's latest troubles too, ahead here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Yes, a warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today, indeed, are Michael Binion and Mary Dzhevsky. Michael's a foreign affairs commentator at The Times. Mary Dzhevsky is a columnist for The Independent and The Guardian here in London. Welcome both of you back to Midori House. Good to have you with us. Let's start today's programme in Brussels, where we heard from surprisingly cheerful-sounding David Cameron a moment ago. EU leaders are gathering for an end-of-year summit. The ongoing refugee crisis, one of the hot topics on the agenda, of course. Almost a million people estimated to have arrived in Europe this year alone. The UK's reform agenda, also one of the main talking points, as Cameron, as we heard, starts his campaign to rewrite Britain's membership terms with the European Union. Let's start with the talks about the refugee crisis. And Michael, perhaps I'll come to you first of all. 900,000 to a million already arrived. Is this summit a sort of a talking shop for empty rhetoric, or can we get somewhere with this huge pressing problem?
Well, it's certainly a talking shop, but I hope there may be some suggestions for concerted action, a sort of cooperative way of handling this, because at the moment Europe has absolutely no policy at all and it's simply chaotic. The open door policy has soured very rapidly. Every country is putting up barriers and defences. Germany is now thinking twice about how many more it can possibly take, and many people in Germany are saying it's already got too many. There are some initiatives that have been pursued. Stronger external frontiers, that's a key thing. A European frontier army, as it were, border guards, and that will be pushed vigorously. Better relations with Turkey, one of the main routes through for people smuggling immigrants into the EU, and possibly an attempt to get the Turks to beef up their frontiers with perhaps a lot of money to encourage them, and various other things such as a voluntary system of taking in refugees directly from the camps rather than those who are already en route struggling through Europe.
Well, Mary, that's an interesting point there. This proposal is causing a bit of a stir, the idea of resettling refugees directly from those camps. Is that likely to fall on deaf ears? Do you think there might be some people who are willing to engage with some of those decisions that are maybe, you know, tougher choices?
Well, I think for many people in the European Union, it will be an attractive proposition. And indeed, David Cameron, who's worried about all sorts of other things, could sit back and say that in that respect, at least, he is vindicated, because his argument has been that Britain, while it's taking a pathetically few number of Syrians, has always argued that they want to take Syrians from the camps and not people who've crossed Europe, on the grounds that that only encourages people smugglers, it encourages people to come by incredibly dangerous routes, and that is the result, that's the cause of so many casualties and disasters. So that's, on the one hand, that's the theory, of course. The practice is completely different, because the problem now is, as both you and Michael have said, there are nearly a million arrivals in Europe already this year. And attempts somehow to portion them out via quotas has totally failed. The response to that has been, as Michael said, for people to put up borders inside the European Union. So that's where we are now. I think it's an entirely, that the most sensible thing that anybody has suggested so far out of all this has been that they need to beef up the external borders, because it was the internal borders were only put up because the external borders had basically failed. Mm. But that's extremely difficult, because then you run across the problem that the border countries, like Greece in particular and Italy, see any pan-European border force as an encroachment on their national sovereignty, because the defence of your borders is the prime responsibility of any state.
So, I mean, does that bring us back to this fundamental question once again, which is that, you know, national interest and the pan-European interest or the pan-EU interest, it simply doesn't, you know, merge in an elegant way. So there's you almost can't have that kind of concerted effort you were describing earlier, Michael, because the real interest never marries up.
That's right. It's not elegant at all. And you add in two other difficulties. One is that terrorists have used this route to infiltrate into Europe, and there's a considerable panic. I mean, the number of terrorists is probably very, very small, but it only takes one, such as the organizer of the Paris massacre or several of his accomplices, to come smuggled in as though they were refugees, for everyone to panic that all refugees are potential terrorists. So that is a complicating factor. And the other factor is Europe's determination to try to keep what they call the Schengen Agreement, the Open Borders Agreement, within Europe, which is actually crumbling before our eyes, because more and more countries have put up borders, including those committed to Schengen, such as Germany. They've put them up temporarily, they say, in order to control the influx of people, particularly those who are economic rather than refugee economic migrants. But once you start reimposing borders, it's very difficult to take them down again, particularly as this move is quite popular. And I think it does really spell the long-term end of Schengen, probably.
A lot of people have pronounced on that. Mary, do you go along with that? Because it's a lot easier to introduce these things back than take them away a second time around.
Absolutely it is. I mean, personally, I just hope that somehow idealism can prevail, because the borderless Europe, inside Europe, to be able to travel from one end of Europe to another without being stopped, without showing your passport, this was a huge achievement. It was something spectacular. But of course, it depended always on the external border being secure. And so long as there weren't that many people coming across those insecure borders, then it wasn't really a serious problem. But now the combination of the numbers and, as Michael said, the perceived threat of terrorists infiltrating themselves across those borders, that threatens to ruin the whole project.
Michael, we sort of mentioned Merkel, and we also talked about Turkey briefly. There'll be sort of side meetings and other little sort of bilaterals going on, but Merkel and a number of EU leaders are going to meet Turkish Prime Minister Davutoglu. Do you think we've seen already sort of earlier migrant agreement? Has that helped in any way? Does that offer a template? Does it merely highlight the folly of a lot of what people are trying to do?
Well, Merkel went to see Erdogan, the president, I think 2 or 3 weeks ago, and they promised immediately to do something, and she offered a fat package of money. And in the first few days, it did look as though there was a sudden drop in the numbers coming across to some of the Greek islands. But actually, that total number doesn't seem to have stopped very much. And they're going to one bit of Lesbos instead of another, apparently. Mm. And I think that the Turks can, if they want, patrol their own frontiers a lot more vigorously. They're holding out for the best deal they can get, because they're actually under some pressure from their European allies on a completely different issue, and that is the fact that they shot down the Russian plane, which has really upset NATO and made NATO think, for goodness sake, what is our ally doing? You know, they're really getting us into a muddle on this. So the Turks are not quite sure. They're trying to be good boys again on the frontiers, because they don't want to be blamed for stirring up things in Syria. And I think the relationship with Turkey by the Europeans is fairly strained.
We'll talk a bit more about Turkey and Russia in a moment, but I did want to mention, we heard from David Cameron at the top of the show. At Mary, you know, the UK's membership is definitely being discussed in broad terms. He sort of started his campaigning with some zeal. What do you make of the start? Is he off to a bright start? How would you grade him so far?
Well, it was a wonderful example of making the most impressive good job out of something which is really a desperate situation. Because if things had gone according to plan, I think David Cameron was hoping that he was going to go to this summit and really everything would have been decided. all the other Europeans would have granted whatever concessions, not exactly the concessions he was wanting, but at least enough that he could bring back, and the whole thing would be signed, sealed and settled in time for Christmas. Now, to have Mr. Cameron talking about momentum as the best thing that can be expected out of this summit, I mean, that is actually a large climb down. But it does suggest that he's now reconciled to seeing whatever happens in the next day or two as being stage one, and that he's really got to gird himself for stage two and maybe even stage three after the new year.
I mean, that's interesting, Michael. I guess a lot of people have said, look, this is the biggest single kind of set of negotiations of Cameron's stewardship, if you like. Is he having to rein that back already? Do you think he is accepting tacitly or explicitly that it's only stage one?
Well, I think he has to, yes, because it's very difficult. He's had no positive response on the main demand. I think the real key demand that he wants to be able to bring back is some kind of limitation on the access to benefits by migrants from the EU in the first 4 months, a sort of ban on them being able to draw benefits. And every single one of the partners is opposed to this. The East Europeans are opposed because most of them send migrants to Britain and they don't want to see any limitation on potential benefits. Not that they draw very many. I mean, it's more a symbolic thing because Poles do not come to Britain to start living on unemployment benefits straight away. They come here to work. But he needs to show that to the public. And that is the one issue on which all the Europeans are adamantly opposed.
Mary, in terms of the wider EU picture, is there a fear that this is about setting precedents? You know, if there is any, you know, rollback, if they soften their stance on any of these positions, that, you know, is that domino effect, or is it more of a symbolism game?
I think the question of benefits and welfare, that is as much a symbolism game as anything else. And of course, for a lot of the East Europeans, it's a very practical thing, that it's the money in their pocket. So I think that's, if you like, separate. But I think for all the European countries, they see the possibility of Britain leaving, of it becoming a realistic prospect. They see that as setting the possible precedent. And they see that as the beginning of the end of the European Union, because they say, well, you know, if Britain ups and leaves, then everybody else is going to find things that they want, things that they're going to bargain for, with the threat of saying, if you don't give us this, we'll leave. Mm. And the whole thing very quickly falls to pieces.
I mean, I guess we're going to be talking about this a lot as we go into 2016, but I mean, what do you make of the whole, you know, Brexit? Where are we at in that? What's the balance in this country? It's a bit of a hard one to call, but
well,
is that a realistic prospect?
I don't. It is a prospect. I won't say. I think it's not a convincing prospect yet. The people who want to leave are making the most noise, but I think in the end it will be decided by the pocketbook, just as the Scottish referendum was. And the Scottish referendum, where there was a real momentum in favour of Scotland declaring independence, when it actually came to voting, the margin for those deciding to stay in the United Kingdom was much larger than people thought. And what people reckoned is that when the voters began to think how much it would cost them personally to leave the United Kingdom, they changed their mind. And if those who are in favour of staying in Europe campaign properly, they will highlight that very high up in their campaign, the actual economic cost to every single taxpayer in Britain of leaving. And then I think there may be a slight pause before people say, yes, let's go it alone.
Well, I'm sure we'll talk about that more in the coming few months. Let's turn our attention, though, back to Russia. We mentioned we would. Vladimir Putin's given his annual end-of-year news conference, which is sort of like we'll talk about FIFA later. This is spectator sport of a different kind. He has admitted that Russia did have a military presence in Ukraine, without specifying exactly what, rather unhelpfully. But in the first part of his press conference, he addressed issues related to Syria and the crisis in relations with Turkey, which we talked about. Mary, he was quite vocal talking about Turkey, predictably, maybe. The shooting down had indeed been an accident, he said. Officials would have called Moscow first and not NATO. What did you make of the sort of rhetoric we heard from Putin today?
Well, I think the first thing that anybody needs to understand about Putin's end-of-year press conference is that this is his gigantic annual opportunity to talk to his fans, basically, across Russia. And every reporter who's there, I mean, basically, you know, the ticket to this press conference, if you're the reporter from your particular region that gets that ticket, that's a huge star on your record. And everybody strives to get a question so that they can show them back home. So the whole thing is huge theatre, and it's directed towards the deep Russian provinces who would otherwise not really get a glimpse of the president. That said, that I think is why he was so forthright and so vocal and so harsh in a lot of ways about the shooting down of the Russian plane, and why he was so uncompromising about Russia's presence in Syria. You know, we're not going to be scared away, etc. I think that if you look at how the episode with the plane has actually played out in diplomacy, then you're looking at something rather different. I think both Turkey and Russia backed off quite quickly. I actually thought that in the first 24 hours, this looked like the most incredibly dangerous, inflammatory incident that could really set off the whole region. And I think there was a call from Obama to Erdogan to say, cool it. And I think by then Putin had understood too that really, that diplomatically, this had to be, as they said, de-escalated.
Mm. Do you think that moment was as sort of tinderbox as that, Michael? And it, you know, calls from Obama, maybe just getting people to step back from the brink?
It was pretty tinderbox, yes. And the Russians were extremely angry. I think the Turks hadn't quite reckoned on the reaction that they would get. It brings to my mind...
Is that feasible, really?
Well, I mean, one wonders. You see, Erdogan is a very similar personality to Putin. This is a clash of people who are just mirror images of each other. And that's why they are both very big egos. And when one ego bashes into another one, you get quite a lot of explosions. Mm. But I think in the Turkish case, I mean, they may have had justification. Well, they produced this record. If it's 17 seconds, as we're talking about, of flying over Turkish airspace, one wonders really whether that was worth shooting down a plane. On the other hand, they argue that Russia has been probing their defences again and again and again, and they had warned them, and they said, next time you do it, we are going to do something about it. But it brings to mind the famous quote from Talleyrand, the old French statesman, it's worse than a crime, it's a blunder.
Mm. Oh, excellent. That's very good. Where does this go next then, Mary? Because, yeah, as you said, that the Putin's performance is generally rather theatrical, and we're not looking maybe for political substance. Was there any clues in there about where it could turn next, whether that diplomatic wrangle will simmer away, or could we see a change in policy?
No, I mean, I think that Putin was playing so much to the domestic gallery that really it's very hard to draw any conclusions about where Russia is really going from here. I think the talk of Russia's involvement in eastern Ukraine was quite interesting, because a lot of people sort of alighted on that and said, you know, this is the first time that Russia has actually acknowledged that it's had troops in eastern Ukraine. I'm not sure that he quite put it like that. What it seemed to me was that he was trying to say that we have special forces there. And of course, we and the Americans and pretty much everybody has special forces all over Syria and Iraq. And so it's not really surprising that Russia would have special forces in eastern Ukraine. It's probably even got them in western Ukraine, if we're honest about it. But I think that the fact that he said that probably clarifies something for somebody.
Just briefly, if he's playing to the domestic gallery, he did. I don't ever like bringing up Donald Trump, but he did mention Donald Trump. He said he was a very talented candidate. Playing to the domestic gallery, maybe. Is that a gag? Michael, why go there, I wonder?
Endorsement by Putin is the surest way to sink any Republican candidate.
So he may be doing everyone a favour.
So probably he knew that. I mean, this has been the case over many American elections. Once the Kremlin says, I really favour this guy, he's finished. And if that was Putin's game, it's quite a clever one.
But it's interesting that, you know, we both observed that Erdogan and Putin are quite similar characters.
Yes.
And you could also see an element of sort of Trump in Putin. And when you look at, you know, he also enjoyed the company of Berlusconi. You know, when you look at that particular constellation, there is something in common there.
What an extraordinary constellation that is. That's a thought to ruminate on for a moment or two. We'll take a short break. Now you're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, my guests, Michael Binion and Mary Dujewski. Up next, how do you starve IS of funding? And FIFA is back on the front pages yet again. Stay tuned.
We're raising the curtain on a brand new show here on Monocle 24 devoted to the best in cinema. Tune in every week to hear from filmmakers, critics, and luminaries of the genre as we shine a spotlight on everything from revivals and the restoration of vintage cuts to Hollywood's golden age and the role of the auteur.
I never think of architectural cities or landscapes in cinema as merely being a kind of neutral backdrop to the action. They are the action themselves.
Hear feature-length interviews with the biggest names, roundtable discussions, special reports, and more as Monocle 24 delves into the rich history of the silver screen. The Cinema Show on Monocle 24, in association with MUBI, premiering Fridays at 20:00 London time, because life is too short for bad films.
Ticking towards 21 minutes past the hour, you're with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, still with me, my guests, Michael Binion and Mary Dujewski. We'll stay with Russia for another story. Together with the United States, the countries announced to the UN the draft of a legally binding resolution to try and starve Islamic State of funding. The document advocates an increase in sanctions against those who do business with the terrorist group and is expected to be approved later in New York. I guess, Mary, what's interesting, well, we'll talk about the document in a moment, but this opportunity for yet more surprising cooperation, perhaps, between the United States and Russia, I don't know, still seems noteworthy on some level.
Yes, well, it seems quite extraordinary because, on the one hand, the pair of them are sort of slagging each other off at every possible opportunity, and then there just seems to be a whole other layer. Things like the Vienna talks, the Riyadh talks, various meetings that are happening all over the world with John Kerry, you know, look carefully where he's going. And suddenly they're both signing this draft resolution at the UN. It does suggest that whatever is going on in Syria, there is less superpower conflict than maybe it looks from where we stand.
Is that maybe, Michael, true that the background possibly is more interesting? I mean, the draft document we'll talk about in a moment, but that is nevertheless interesting that these machinations are happening nevertheless.
Very much so. I think two things are at work. First of all, Russia needs to reach out to the Americans in Syria because it's a very good way of getting the Americans off their backs over Ukraine. You can't impose new sanctions on Russia over Ukraine if at the same time you're seeking their help in formulating a response to what's going on in Syria. And the other thing, I think, which is quite tricky for the West in particular, is that they're gradually coming around to the idea that Russia's probably right over Syria, and that the Russian plan is probably the only one that has any chance of flying. Namely, you've got to get as many of the actors, including Assad, into a conference room, kicking and screaming, and bash their heads together and get some draft document, and only then can you dump Assad, as Russia's made it fairly clear it's quite happy to do, once they've got a kind of political overall settlement. And the Russian point that they made all along is, if you get rid of Assad, what will you put in his place, or who would you put in his place? And the West has begun to think, well, a very good question. That's why the sort of gradual alignment of their policies is taking place. They can't, neither side is able just to say, well, we were right all along. And they're sort of, there's a rapprochement in their policies in the region.
What about the substance then of the document? Because we've talked quite a lot on Monocle 24, and other analysts have looked and said, you know, to tackle this organisation, you need to cut off the funding, follow the money. It's a bit of an old refrain. Mary, is there anything here that suggests to you that that could actually work?
Well, I think it's very difficult to see how it could work, because I think that the people who are sort of banking on saying, well, if we cut off the oil sales, then we've cut off the prime source of funding, that's actually not true, because it appears that the prime source of funding is not the oil, it's the local taxes that Islamic State raises from the people on the territory that it actually controls. So I think it's not going to stall that. The other thing that I actually only learnt this morning was that the oil sales have not only been going on already for 2 or 3 years, But they've been tracked by all these convoys of trucks have apparently been tracked. And of course, when you think about it, that's entirely logical because there's reconnaissance, American reconnaissance especially, everywhere. If they hadn't seen huge convoys of trucks, then that would be very surprising. Hmm. But it was pointed out to me that there were reconnaissance pictures were produced of the ancient city of Palmyra before and after, within hours of the temple being destroyed. And yet nobody will actually come clean on knowing about the existence of the convoys and the routes they were taking. But that knowledge is there.
I mean, it's quite striking, and may well be true, that these local taxes are where the body of the money comes from. But with the oil, you know, where is that going? Who is buying it?
Well,
what more do we know?
The Russians said within minutes of the plane being shot down, they said, well, the Turks are buying a lot of it. And that's true. Even more surprising, or more, in a way, staggering, Assad himself is buying the oil from his arch enemies, because actually it suits Assad very well to have ISIS there as the arch enemy, because then he gets the West off his back, because the West makes ISIS, Islamic State, the main target. And he's quite happy to buy the oil because he needs it, and he's been buying it.
It's a pretty extraordinary state of affairs, frankly. But finally, on tonight's show, we turn to the wonderful world of football. A change of pace for you both. I'm not going to ask you about the succession to Jose Mourinho here at Chelsea in London. Instead, it's FIFA making the headlines again. The Swiss Justice Ministry has announced the decision to freeze millions of Swiss francs worth of assets in bank accounts belonging to FIFA. Mary, I don't know, I'm a bit of a football fan, but I find this incredibly depressing. The scandal deepens. It's the worst in over a century of often illustrious history, now rather tarnished. More than 40 entities, people charged by US prosecutors. I guess the first question is, should any of this come as a surprise anymore?
Well, I don't think it really does come as any surprise. And of course, it's not just FIFA, it's practically every international top-notch sporting body that is somehow tainted. And all these stories have been coming out over the last couple of years. The interesting thing, one of the most interesting things to me is that the FIFA scandal only really erupted, it only saw the light of day, because some of the funds which were presumed to be corrupt went through the American banking system. So you have this really sort of extraordinary situation where the United States, which has almost zero interest in international football, that it was actually the catalyst for the explosion of this whole scandal.
And Michael, now once the sort of edifice starts to crumble, I guess we shouldn't be too surprised by the scale of it. But I guess that point Mary makes is rather interesting about the bigger picture for sports governance. It does seem that, you know, whether it's the International Olympic Committee or FIFA, everyone's got a problem. There's corruption alleged everywhere. Are we going to see, you know, an even greater diminishing of the appetite for countries to actually be involved with these things? You've got questions already in Rio for next year. The Japanese seem in two minds about the Olympic Games. Is it going to be purely the preserve of sort of, you know, despotic countries who want these things as vanity projects? Is that the sad end game?
Well, yes. And as you say, it has affected all kinds of different sports. I mean, athletics is one of the ones that has got into deep trouble just recently. And the secondary question of doping, I mean, accusations now that Russia has been vigorously engaged in promoting or encouraging doping of some of its athletes. The other question, if you look at all the different sports in the world where there have been accusations of bribery, corruption, cricket is another one. India and Pakistan have had accusations hurled at them on many occasions. The problem is there's so much money involved, not only in staging the events, but in people who bet on the events, people who try to buy the players or sell the players. There's a vast amount of money needed. Now, as for staging Olympics, I think the appetite is beginning to wane a bit. We saw a very interesting result in Hamburg, one of the contenders for the future Olympic Games, where the voters said, no, thank you.
And quite decisively with it. As
they
well,
did, yeah. Yes, because they didn't want all the disruption. But I think also they were fairly cynical about what this actually really meant, and the whole corruption issue has made people more cynical.
Well, and the British were very negative about the Olympics until it actually happened.
Well, when it happened,
they suddenly became hugely enthusiastic. But I think as to whether these organisations will actually sort of die a death, I think that's not going to happen, because I think if you look at international football, this has such a following.
Yes.
Somebody's got to organise this.
Yes.
Somebody's got to decide who's going to play who. Somebody's got to draw the lot. Somebody's got to organise it. So I think, you know, if not FIFA, then there will be something after FIFA.
Wonderful stuff. And there, I'm afraid, we must leave it. Wonderful hearing from you both today. Mary Tejeski and Michael Binion, our guests on Midori House. Thanks for being with us on the programme. Just about all we have time for. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jamie Waters. And thanks too to our studio manager, Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Bill Luthi's playing music from Monocle's international playlist. At 1900, join Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, for today's Urbanist, The Daily. More on the stories we've been discussing and a host more besides at 2200 London time. Don't miss it. We're back with this show at the same time tomorrow. Goodbye.